Indianapolis Motor Speedway, our ethanol summit. I don't have to tell you that the search for viable alternative fuels has become more acute with each passing day, and the very fact that we're at a location, the 92nd running of the Indianapolis 500, where race cars are rocketing around this track at breakneck speeds powered by ethanol, is an indication that here is one such solution. We have a variety of special guests with us that we want to acknowledge first, including Reese Nanfito of Epic. I don't know if Reese is with us. Reese, welcome to Indianapolis. Bobby Rahal of Rahal Letterman Racing, of course, a former champion of the Indianapolis 500, a team owner, and I think, as you know, this month, a very interested father. Bobby's got a run for 10 o'clock. We're delighted that he stopped by to see us. And Roberto Gianetti de Fonseca, the foreign trade director of the Brazilian Federation of Industries. Is he with us today? Okay. Well, we'll begin appropriately enough with the gentleman who was the president of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, Mr. Joey Chitwood.
Thank you. Good morning. What a great day. Kind of excited with the Indy 500 this weekend that so many of you have decided to join us this morning to talk about ethanol. I have to tell you, one of the things that the Speedway is most proud of is about being an international leader in motorsports entertainment. But we take that to the next level, and it's not just about entertainment. It's the things that we do at this facility that we think can help not only the United States, but really around the world in terms of setting the bar high. And the IndyCar Series has really set that tone by running 100% fuel-grade ethanol in their cars. And we've seen Chevrolet take the huge step of creating the concept car, the E85 Chevrolet Corvette, to pace the field for this year's Indy 500. So when you can see that kind of synergy between what's an on-track product and then taking it from a commercial use, it's something we're most proud of. I do want to share a story with you. This past weekend, I was at the Armed Forces Day breakfast here, and Senator Lugar has been visiting us at this breakfast for probably 20-some-odd years. In fact, we talk about the creation of Armed Forces Day, and we actually think it occurred when Senator Lugar was Mayor Lugar of Indianapolis. That's how long he's been a supporter out here, and he was so complimentary of the Holman George family and the Speedway for taking that step with ethanol. And in this challenging economic environment, the look for alternative fuels, other ways to be better at what we do is very important. And so as we continue to find the right solution, it's nice to know that we're part of it. And that's the key, is that I'm not sure if anyone really knows the ultimate end-all right answer, but to be part of the next wave of fuel and how it can be used on track and in passenger cars. We're proud that the Indianapolis Motor Speedway has played a small role in that. So, again, welcome. I really appreciate everyone being here today. We've got a fantastic event in front of us as we get ready to celebrate the Indianapolis 500. And one other thing that I would like to share as we continue to strive to be better, whether through its on-track product, safety, fuel, the Speedway is celebrating its centennial celebration next year. The Indianapolis Motor Speedway turns 100 in 2009. It's a very special anniversary for us, and I would expect that you'll continue to see us lead the challenge and set the bar high as we look at our next 100 years in business. So with that, thank you and good morning.
Yeah, very exciting time in the next year as we begin to celebrate that centennial of the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. I want to direct your attention now. Andy Miller, the director of Indiana Department of Agriculture, could not be with us, but he has prepared a message for us, and if you'll turn your attention to the video screen.
Well, thank you very much for the opportunity to speak with you this morning. I sincerely apologize that I couldn't join you at the track today. On behalf of Governor Daniels and Lieutenant Governor Skillman, I'd like to start by thanking Joey Chitwood, the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, and the Indianapolis 500, first and foremost, for your continued commitment to Indiana and to Indianapolis. Through the years, your contributions have been so numerous and so beneficial. Today, though, I'd like to specifically thank you for your commitment to ethanol. There is no doubt that your innovation in embracing ethanol has helped propel this industry forward, not only in Indiana, but around the country. I'd also like to thank General Motors. Again, first and foremost, General Motors for their commitment to Indiana. Many of you from outside of Indiana may not know, but General Motors is one of our leading employers. Thousands of Hoosiers for several decades have relied on General Motors, not only for great cars, but also for a source of living. And I also would like to thank General Motors for your commitment to ethanol, particularly in introducing several new flexible fuel vehicles that we're seeing pop up around the state and around the country. You know, 3 years ago, Governor Mitch Daniels committed to Indiana that we would see an economic comeback in our state. And very early on, he recognized that to make that happen, we were going to have to embrace the biofuel sector, the alternative energy sector. And without much fanfare, we began, and after 3 short years, we've gone from being way behind to being a national leader. We went from one ethanol plant to this year we will have 12 biofuel plants operational. That's both ethanol and biodiesel. Those plants are bringing $2.5 billion of new investment to our state. That's billion with a B. And what's really neat is that all of that investment is coming to small towns and rural communities, places like Claypool and Clymers and Alexandria, places that a lot of folks hadn't even heard of or knew that existed in the great state of Indiana. Along with this has come thousands of new jobs and millions of new farm income. And as we move forward, as we think about the next generation, the governor and lieutenant governor are equally excited about embracing things like cellulosic ethanol, wind, coal, whatever it might be that Indiana can do with its natural resources to be a participant in the next wave of new energy. Now, it's important to note that as we embark on things like ethanol, there's clearly a lot of challenges. And I think it's important that we take a minute and think about and address our challenges. First and foremost, those of us that believe in biofuels and alternative energy must embrace these very realistically. We must understand what they can do and what they can't do. We must never paint them as something bigger than they are. And whenever we meet a challenge or meet something that's in our way, we must embrace it wholeheartedly and not let it stop us. In doing that, we'll be able to combat those folks much like we're seeing right now, those naysayers that would like to paint ethanol, for example, as an evil, something that needs to be taken care of. There is a lot of hysteria in the market today, but I think if we continue to show that our commitment is there, that we're realistic about that commitment, we'll be able to address even those challenges. But in the end, what we know is that alternative energy, things like ethanol, have a phenomenal impact on our family farms around Indiana. They have a phenomenal impact in breathing new life into our small towns and our rural communities. They can and will be a major driver of economic growth in a state like Indiana. But probably most importantly, we know that they can help the U.S. do what we set out to do, which is find new and innovative ways of being energy independent. So again, enjoy your time today. I'm sorry I can't be with you. Enjoy the great Indianapolis Motor Speedway, the Indianapolis 500, and our great capital city here in Indianapolis. Thank you very much.
I can tell you as a citizen of Indiana, this is a very important issue for us. And certainly when we think about the imprint of ethanol, it is a global issue and a global issue that continues to get everyone's attention. And perfect example of that is the gentleman we're going to bring to the stage right now. He captivated us in so many ways as a young man, as a Formula One champion. He became well known across the world. We were delighted in America when he decided to bring his talents to the Indianapolis Motor Speedway. We watched him win a tremendous duel with Al Unser Jr. to win the Indianapolis 500, and subsequently is a two-time Indianapolis 500 winner. But in so many areas where successful and prominent athletes cannot make the transition to the world post-athletics, this man has become a very successful businessman. Make no mistake about it, he is renowned across the globe. It's a name that's synonymous with greatness. But when he comes to Indianapolis, there's one way we think of him. He's one of the true kings of the brickyard. Please welcome Emerson Fittipaldi.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. I should talk a little bit about the history of Brazil involvement in ethanol that not many people know, but has a long history, has a lot of tradition, ethanol. And in 1925 was the first time that ethanol was blended with gasoline. I mean, it goes as far back as 1925. In 1931, ethanol start to be the official mix with gasoline in small proportions in Brazil. And then in 1975, on the first oil crisis, the government creates the new ethanol program. And that's when the sugarcane ethanol producers start growing up very quickly in size, investments, and Brazil was the leading country to have ethanol on pumps, on regular gas stations all over Brazil at that time. Since then, we live and we develop this know-how technology with ethanol up to today. 1979 was the first time that we had E100 in Brazil. We had 100% ethanol on the pump stations, on the any gas station in Brazil, they have 100% of ethanol. And then 2003 was what we call the new technology that reached Brazil, that we call the flex fuel, flex power cars, was developed by the car industry in Brazil together with Magneti Marelli, with Bosch, the small unit that permits the flex fuel cars to have any type of fuel. As you know, you can stop on a gas station, put just 100% ethanol in Brazil, and then you burn half tank, and you stop at the next station, you can put half gasoline. And they blend. This unit was developed by the car manufacturer in Brazil. General Motors Brazil has been one of the first manufacturers to believe on the program, to introduce on the new cars, and has been very, very successful since 2003. And as everybody knows, this technology that was invented and developed in Brazil, now other countries are going to use, including the States. I think starts 3 years ago in the States to be used, the flex fuel cars. And I think that's is a win-win situation, because for the user of the car, he don't depend on any type of fuel. He can mix any type of fuel and keep going. Now, Brazil's situation today, the regular fuel of Brazil has already E20, E25. That means we're already burning ethanol in any type of fuel in Brazil for cars. Now, the flex fuel cars already over 5 million cars being delivered the last few years to the Brazilian public. 90% of the new cars, new automobiles in Brazil now are flex fuel with 10 brands with 63 different models. I mean, that's how Brazil is positioning itself with the flex fuel cars. And 100% of GM vehicles produced in Brazil are flex fuel. It's the only car manufacturer who makes 100% of the car. I mean, General Motors is leading this field in Brazil for many years. And actually, just about all the 33,000 gas pump stations in Brazil have at least one E100 pump available to the public. That's north, south, east, west of Brazil. You can stop just about any gas station and have E100. I think it's great for the Brazilian economy. It's great for not to be dependent on the countries, on other countries. As everybody knows, renewable energy, and as same as the state of Indiana, is providing a lot of work, a lot of income on different parts of Brazil. I mean, there's been a lot of tremendous develop on the countryside of Brazil. Now, talk a little bit about my history of ethanol. In 1961, when I was 14 years old, my first motorcycle race with two-stroke engine was an Italian motorcycle called Mondio. I was my own mechanic, and I remember that was the first one that I put ethylic, we call ethanol, alcohol to improve the performance. I had a more higher compression engine to put ethanol. I advanced the electrical point, and I won the race. And I'm sure I was one of the first guys to run ethanol on a motorcycle in Brazil many, many years ago. And after 2 years of being successful, I raced from 14 to 16, then the local federation forbidding ethanol because I was winning all the races. Same time, I was racing go-kart with ethanol in Brazil. That's when I started my go-kart career. Now, 1975, when I had with my brother my Copersucar team, we are sponsored by Copersucar, who was a cooperative of sugar cane and producers of ethanol and sugar at that time. I mean, there's a lot of history in Brazil with ethanol. And, you know, in 1984, I had one of my dreams to come and race Indianapolis. Not many people know, but when I joined Team Lotus in 1970, Colin Chapman was here with Jim Clark and won Indianapolis. Always when I was having dinner with Colin, I always keep asking, how was to race Indianapolis? What was to go Indianapolis? And back of my mind, I always want to come to Indianapolis. It happened first time in 1984. And it was methanol. But, you know, as Indianapolis was already using methanol at that time. Now, going to my memories in Indianapolis, I mean, I had great memories. I had a lot of fun. I had a lot of good people behind me in Indianapolis. Everybody, I mean, I always say the 3 weeks I spent in Indiana was always enjoyable. I always had my family here and was always a challenge. I mean, we only look for four corners. They look exactly the same, but every lap they are different because of the wind, the tire conditions, the amount of fuel you have on board. It's always a challenge to be in Indianapolis. And as everybody knows, it's one of, if not the biggest race event in the world. And I was very proud to be part of the history of Indianapolis with Chip Ganassi and Patrick Racing, the first win we had in 1989 with Penske chassis. And then in 93, driving for Roger, was my second victory here. And I have great memories. It was always great to be in Indianapolis. When I start talking about race, I'm not going to stop. I have to stop now. Going back to the ethanol commitment, I want to congratulate the Indianapolis Motor Speedway, you know, the Holman George family, to take this leading position in the world to have IRL run 100% ethanol. That's example of how motor race can show the world, can show the public how efficient the engines run with ethanol. And I think that's a great step towards the promotion, the marketing, the endorsement of ethanol in the world through motor race. And that's thanks to the Speedway, to Indianapolis Motor Speedway, to achieve and to launch and as a global category. And I know, and we all know, the next few years, many other type of racing are going to go full ethanol, like you guys start here. And I want to thanks as well, you know, the Tony George and everybody at Speedway to invite me to drive the pace car, and special for GM Chevrolet. I think it's a very special year. It will be the first time ever that the pace car will be E85 I've been here a few months ago driving the Corvette. It's a great honor for me to be back here driving the pace car this year. Again, the message of the pace car will be showing to the world that a passenger car, even a high-performance car like the Corvette, will run E85 and runs beautiful. I've been taking the press like a month ago here around the Speedway, and we're getting close to 180 miles per hour at the end of the straight. And I'm sure one of your guys today are going to have fun. We're going to run again the Corvette today. I mean, General Motors, as a leading car manufacturer in the world, not just ethanol, but the new type of energy, the new type of energy that will be used different for the next generations. And General Motors' effort worldwide is tremendous. Marcus, who is here, comes from the Unica, the biggest group of ethanol producers in the world, are going to give you guys the explanation where the ethanol industry in Brazil, how we are doing, what's our goal for the future. And Marcus on Sunday is flying to Sweden to meet with the Saab people that's owned by General Motors, because Sweden is one of the most advanced countries in the world using ethanol. And Marcus will be there working with Saab, with the Swedish government on the ethanol program. And I'm sure, again, that's another, you know, input, another effort, another belief, another endorsement from General Motors for our future. And as everybody knows, the work we are doing today, the group here is going to benefit the new generation, is going to benefit our grandchild, my grandchild, my grand-grandchild in the future, because we are going green, and that's what the world needs now. And God bless everybody. Thank you very much.
Well, I hate to let this out, but you heard the story about Demerson and the motorcycle at 14. My sources have told me that perhaps Emerson has been stashing away the pace car in an unused garage in Gasoline Alley. My sources say he has it tricked out and he's not willing to give up the lead, at least for the first 50 laps. So we'll keep an eye on him when he gets out there. Well, he has tipped our hand about some of the important work of this individual who comes to us with great ideas and great visions, and we appreciate him coming from Brazil. It's Marcos Jank from Unica, the largest ethanol co-op in Brazil. And Marcos, would you please join us?
Thank you very much. It's really a pleasure to be with you today. Thank you to GM Chevy for this wonderful opportunity to come and to talk a little bit about our experience on ethanol. GM is probably the company that's doing the best job in the world in terms of really making possible this revolution of flex fuel cars and green cars from ethanol. We've been working together in Brazil, and we believe that our experience need to be replicated in many countries. As Emerson told, Sweden is a country that's moving fast on the E85. We have our experience of pure ethanol for 30 years, more than 30 years. And the U.S. will go there too, I am sure. And it's also wonderful to talk with Emerson. Emerson is like an idol for all Brazilians, an icon for everybody. He's really a wonderful example for the development of the races in Brazil and pilots and everything. It's really wonderful. Thank you very much for inviting me. Unica is the leading company, is the leading sugarcane industry association. We represent 110 producers and mills in Brazil. And we are responsible for 60% of the ethanol and sugar production in Brazil. And more, Brazil is also an emerging leader in bioelectricity. Bioelectricity is probably the third product today of our industry. The first product is still sugar. The second is ethanol. And the third is electricity. Still very small, but growing very fast. And we believe, I will show you some numbers about that. And we cover many areas at UNICA, like environmental and energy, technology, international trade, corporate social responsibility, regulations, etc. And we have offices in Washington, D.C. Joel is here, is our chief representative in the U.S. And we have also offices in Brussels. Next, please. So the Brazilian experience on renewable energy has more than 30 years now. We started in the 70s, and today our energy matrix is 45% renewable, compared to only 13% in the world and only 6% in OECD countries. So Brazil has been really moving very fast. Next, here you see the role of sugarcane in the Brazilian energy matrix. It's 16% of the matrix. It's the second most important source of energy, just behind oil, and now more important than hydroelectricity. This is an incredible move. And why? Next, please. Because 45%, no, just come back one, please. Just back, yes. 45% of the Brazilian fuel is today ethanol. 3% of electricity going fast to 10 and 15%. And also sugar, but ethanol and electricity are now 16% of the energy matrix, more important than hydroelectricity, and all biomass together they come to 45%. Next, this is the global ethanol production in the next years. The U.S. is now more important than Brazil, moving very, very fast, 9 billion gallons this year, up to 15 billion gallons in 2012, and 35 billion gallons in 2022. Brazil is now producing around 6 billion gallons, 5, 6 billion gallons. So we are really moving fast, but the U.S. is moving faster than Brazil. And both countries now represent 75% of the world production of ethanol. And that's why we need to cooperate. I believe that it's not a question of competition, but it's a question of cooperating to find a solution to very expensive oil and very pollutant oil in the world. Because these are the two problems today, the scarcity of oil reaching $130 a barrel, and the emissions that comes from oil, from gasoline. If we use ethanol, we can reduce a lot of those emissions. So this is our goal together, is to really find solutions to a world that is extremely dependent on oil. And Brazil and U.S. should work together on that. Next. Ethanol in Brazil is now surpassing gasoline. Next. So right now, next one, please. Right now, what you see here is 90% of the new cars are flex fuel today. And you see there that it's around 20% of the total fleet, because the flex cars in Brazil started in 2002, 2003, much later than in the U.S. The U.S. has flex fuel cars for many, many years already. But the difference in Brazil is that we started later, but much faster. And today, 90% of the new cars are flex fuel. And not only because we have now flex fuel cars, but we have full distribution of ethanol in Brazil. Full distribution. So we have in all gas stations, we have dedicated pumps to ethanol. So the combination of a flex fuel fleet of 5 million cars and distribution of competitive ethanol in all gas stations makes this revolution coming very, very quickly. So today, 20% of the total fleet. Next, in 2012, 50% of the total fleet. And then it goes and goes up to 100%. So we will not come back to gasoline cars. Brazil will move to a fleet that will be
flex fuel, completely flex fuel in the future. Right now, that all new cars are, but they are replacing the old cars. So in probably 10 years or 15 years, all cars in Brazil will be flex fuel, except the imported vehicles. But we believe that in other countries, they will do the same. We hope that GM, Ford, and other companies will do that in Europe and U.S. in order to have flex fuel cars. It's really fabulous, these possibilities. Next, this is what's happening there. Fuel ethanol is now more important than gasoline in terms of consumption since last February. February was the first time in history that we had fuel pure ethanol more important than gasoline in Brazil. Next. And the prices. This is very, very important. The first line there, you see the average gasoline price in Brazil, around 2.5 reais per liter, which is around 1.5 dollars per liter, no? Around that. So this is gasoline, the blue line. Then you have the ethanol line, which is ethanol prices in Brazil going down. And then you see there the ethanol export prices of Brazil going down very, very strongly in the latest month. So that's why we've been trying to export more. Now we have a surplus. 15% of our ethanol is exported now, but we believe that in the future the global market for ethanol will be created. So this is our situation. Ethanol has been in the last years 50-60% of the price of gasoline in Brazil. And that's why people move to ethanol. Next. Fuel ethanol is not limited only to cars. As Emerson showed you, motorcycles are there. I didn't know that was so far away. I thought it was 10 years before. And Emerson just told me that it was in the 60s. So I would now put the picture there of Emerson running on pure ethanol motorcycle. That's really wonderful. Right now, this year, Honda and Yamaha, the two major companies in Brazil, are launching flex fuel motorcycles in Brazil right now. So we are going to have a full flex fuel motorcycles industry in Brazil too. We are also studying the possibility to have airplanes running on ethanol. Turbo hélices, I don't know how to say that, medium airplanes, crop dusting airplanes are now flex fuel in Brazil already, alcochemical industry, bioplastics, biorefineries, boats, motor boats, so there buses, we are now launching the first use of buses, pure ethanol buses with diesel engines in São Paulo City, you know, diesel engines running with ethanol. That's really a revolution. That started in Europe, and we are incorporating that in Brazil. Scania is now launching those buses. So that's really moving very fast. Next. And we did that with 1% of the arable land. 1%. So it's really... a plant, sugarcane is a very old plant. I like to say that there is nothing oldest in Brazil as sugarcane. Sugarcane is our first economic activity, and there is a few sectors today more modern than sugarcane in Brazil because of this move from the food world to the energy world. Sugarcane today now is an energy plant and extremely efficient in terms of converting sun and you see natural resources from the soil into ethanol into bioelectricity. So we did that with 1% of the arable land. Next is 3 million hectares in a total arable land of 340 million hectares, and Brazil total area is 850 million hectares. So Brazil has only 40% of the area is arable land in Brazil because of the Amazon. The Amazon is 50% of the country. And just 1% of the 40% is for sugarcane. So it's really a very small part of the country. And next It's very concentrated in São Paulo State, a little bit on the northeast coast. Both regions are 2,000 kilometers from the Amazon. 1,000 miles from the Amazon region. So it's not happening in the Amazon, as sometimes people say around the world. It's really happening in the traditional agricultural areas. And it's not moving, it's not troubling, it's not making trouble to food, too. In Brazil, food has been growing more than sugarcane. Soybeans, for example, or corn, or beef, or dairy. All those activities have been growing much faster than sugarcane. In our case, it's not food versus fuel, but it's food plus fiber, plus fruits. We say that all Fs we can do together with more efficiency. The food, fuel, fiber, feed, fruits, and forests all together. All Fs, six Fs together. We can do that. Because it's really a question of technology. It's a question of using the arable land that we have today in a much more efficient way, as the U.S. did in the last 100 years. The question of ethanol, it's really a question of technology. It's moving from 3,000 liters per hectare as you have today in U.S. to 7,000 liters per hectare as we are now on sugarcane, to 12, 14,000 liters per hectare on second generation, on biomass. And we can do that in the U.S., we can do that in Brazil. We can grow two times, three times our current levels of productivity with the second generation. So we need to give this space to renewables. Renewables are now just 1% of the fossil fuel world. It's nothing, absolutely nothing. And we need to try to move that. Next. Sugarcane is the best biomass feedstock today. Next one. Reduces greenhouse gas emissions in 90% compared to gasoline. It's better than grains and sugar beet. Next, very good energy balance, seven times better than corn in terms of renewable energy coming from fossil fuel inputs. Next, very high production yield, 7,000 liters per hectare, as I told you. Corn is 3,000 liters. And next, and self-sufficient. All mills are self-sufficient in energy. We don't need to buy energy on the mills. We can do that burning the sugarcane biomass, the bagasse, and the straw. And this is the fantastic thing that happens in sugarcane and happens also in other activities, is that you can use 100% of the plant. Next one. Bioelectricity is the next frontier now. Let me explain a little bit what's bioelectricity. Next one. During 500 years, we've been just using the sugarcane juice, one third of the energy of the plant. When you crush sugarcane, when you press sugarcane, you have the juice, the bagasse, and the straw that stays in the fields. During 500 years, we just used one third of the energy of the plant, juice, the sugarcane juice to produce sugar and ethanol. Now, there is a new frontier coming from the use of the biomass, the bagasse and the straw. And this is extremely good to produce in the short-term electricity, in the long-term ethanol. And then next one, and the latest one, this is what will happen in our country. Sugar will lose importance. Ethanol will be 51% of the matrix, of the sugarcane matrix, and bioelectricity will be 16%. And ethanol and bioelectricity will grow much faster than sugar. So in 20 years, the name of the plant will not be more sugarcane. It will be probably ethanol cane or electricity cane instead of sugarcane, because it's really moving very fast in this direction. Next one. And this is the availability, areas where we can produce sugarcane. More than 100 countries today are producing sugarcane, especially in South America, in Africa, a little bit in Asia, India, China, Australia. More than 100 countries. It's much more democratic than oil. On the fossil fuel world, the current 200 countries in the world are extremely dependent to only 20 countries. Very complicated countries in terms of political situations, etc. If we move to renewables, not only we go to renewable source that can goes forever, much more important reduction of greenhouse gas emissions, alternative to very expensive oil, but also much more democratic, because you could have 100 developing countries producing biofuels to the 200 countries that are consuming fuels in the world. So this is a very important issue, I think, in the U.S., in Brazil, in many other parts of the world. It's much more democratic. So let's give an opportunity for ethanol. And let's cooperate to make this happen in the world. Okay, thank you very much. This is the last one.
Well, thank you very much, and what an informative and wide-ranging talk that was. We appreciate you coming and delivering it. Next up, we're going to bring up the president and CEO of Lifeline Foods, who produces E100 racing fuel for IndyCar products, Mr. Bill Becker.
Pleased to be here. Our company, Lifeline Foods, is a food company, and we've been in business for 7 years. Extremely pleased to be the sole provider of ethanol to the Indy circuit, something we're very, very proud of. But I want to talk a little about the industry, the corn-based ethanol industry, and we've been beat up a little bit. And I want to explain some innovation that's online to help solve a lot of these issues. When people talk production from U.S. farmland, how are we going to create opportunities to provide food and fuel? I'd like to explain our process a little bit, and that might help you to understand how this can be accomplished. Basically, the corn kernel, as we bring it in and mill it, has several components. You don't think of corn as total starch. Corn has hard starches, soft starches, fiber around the exterior, and the germ, which is really like, if you will, it's like the yolk of the egg. It's the growing point. It's the live organism in the kernel. There are a lot of nutrients in the germ. There's corn oil. It's a food product. There's high protein products and very, very valuable nutrients within that germ. Our process separates all those components. We take it apart first as opposed to a dry grind process, and we segregate out the food, and we take 100% of the available food, the starches, off to the cereal industry and the snack industry, and we're one of the largest snack suppliers, snack ingredient suppliers in the U.S. Then you have this leftover softer starch that's very, very good product to make ethanol out of. It converts very easily. And it also, by doing that and removing the fiber, we're able to create much higher quality distiller's grains, because that leftover product, because the fiber wasn't in there, is a much higher protein. We're in the 45% range of proteins, which is almost 1.5 times the normal amount. So for animal feeds, it's a much enhanced product. The really unique thing, though, is we can take the fiber that we've taken off and utilize that in a gasifier for our energy needs. So the natural gas that we utilized for conversion of ethanol starch into sugar, then into ethanol, is less than 1/2 of the total need for a conventional plant. So all these things, then talk a little about the food-grade oil that we can extract. So all these things are the future of the industry, And a conventional ethanol plant can add these type of technologies on the front end, and that's where the industry's going. Our focus as a company, though, we're 51% farmer-owned company. There's a cooperative that owns 51%. Is how much energy and food can we extract per acre? That's what's extremely important, is what can we harvest from U.S. farmland and bring to the public in terms of food and fuel. So what we have to do is think of the crops we have available. Corn is a unique crop. You know, we've just talked about the kernel, the seed, if you will. There's a lot of fiber in corn, and there's been a lot of talk about cellulosic conversion. I believe that is a big part of our future. But don't forget, corn is a member of the grass family. Corn produces a lot of tonnage, a lot of foliage. A lot of research we're doing is to capture that food value from corn. In addition, we've got cellulosic material we can capture. We've got protein for food. We've got oil for food. We've got all these components. And that I believe, is the future of the industry and one of the answers we're going to have moving forward. So that's all I have for now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I'm delighted to bring this next guest. As a college professor myself, we sometimes get the rap that the things that we do are not in the real world and have few applications in day-to-day life. The fact of the matter is that there are many great applications in day-to-day life from things that happen in universities. And with us today is a gentleman, Dr. Michael Laddish, Purdue University Director of Laboratory of Renewable Resources Engineering and Distinguished Professor of Agricultural and Biological Engineering. He is an expert on cellulosic fuels, which we just talked about. So, Dr. Laddish, if you please come forward.
I don't know. Are you a Boilermaker?
I'm a Hoosier.
Oh, okay. Hoosier, there's a real competition between wherever it is, the greatest university in Bloomington and Purdue University. Anyhow, I'm here today. I'm actually the chief technology officer at Moscoma Corporation. Purdue has actually arranged for a leave of absence, and I originally started with Brian Stater and Bowen, and then Moscoma now has basically retained some of the technology that's been developed at Purdue University, and now is being developed. And so I'm very happy to present some of the things that are going on at Moscoma in next-generation biofuels. In fact, this is part of GM's strategy for getting into ethanol, and specifically cellulosic ethanol. And I think your previous comments regarding Lifeline and some of the farmer co-ops are right on the money. I think that corn, in fact, is indeed a very valuable resource, but the next generation, in order to take us to the sorts of levels that Marcus John just talked about for ethanol, will require cellulosic conversion. And that's what Moscoma is all about, non-food, cellulosic conversion to ethanol, and ultimately to other types of bioproducts. Next slide, please. First of all, we'll talk about the cellulose supply chain. Indeed, it's very important to realize that we need the feedstocks. And I thought the pictures of the cane growing in Brazil brought to mind that how important it is to have the feedstock, have it grown efficiently with minimal inputs, and then also being able to convert this feedstock to a ethanol product in a low-cost manner. Next slide, please. So the current bioprocessing requires pretreatment. That's the softening of the cellulosic material. And if you can imagine the material going into a plant like this, is very similar to what we would have in the States, mulch that you would put on the ground next to your plants this time of year. That's the consistency of it. But this needs to be softened up. Then it's hydrolyzed. Hydrolysis basically extracts the sugars. In sugar cane, we just saw that there's three basic materials, sugar, and then also the sugar cane and the leaves themselves, split up to one-third. We're going after the sugar that is locked up in the cellulosic portion, the non-food portion. After that, it's fermented to ethanol, and that's a technology that's been around with us for a long time. Finally, it's distilled, and we get our fuel ethanol product from that. Next slide, please. So the current processing uses chemicals, uses enzymes, and yeast. Moscoma is different. What we're looking at here is pretreatment. This is a graphic or a cartoon which shows, which shows that, in fact, the cellulosic materials are protected by nature so that the plants will grow, stand up straight, be resistant against pests. And so the way we represent this is the dark line is the lignin, the light lines are cellulose and hemicellulose. Next. And the hemicellulose basically ties everything together. What pretreatment does is after the plant is harvested and stored for some period of time, it goes into the plant, and the pretreatment itself, in our case, we only use water, we don't add chemicals, breaks up this material into smaller fragments on a molecular level so that the enzymes and the catalysts we use can access the cellulose, which is in fact a form of stored sugar. Next slide, please. So the next generation bioprocessing, already being implemented in the laboratories and soon in a demo plant at Moscoma, use a pretreatment where water is added, heat is added, it's cooked to soften it up, and then microbial biocatalysts, which will carry out both hydrolysis and fermentation in the same tank. It saves a lot of money. It's environmentally very attractive. Then we'll produce the ethanol. Ultimately, next slide, please, the pretreatment will, in fact, and I hate to say this, my research area, by the way, is pretreatment, but I remember being at an American Chemical Society meeting or a meeting with Moscoma, and someone asked, what happens to my research area in 10 years? And I said, if we're successful, it'll be, in fact, not needed. So it's hard to say, but what we're now doing is going toward the last step, which would be you would take your cellulosic material and then add microorganisms, which already exist in nature, by the way, but they've been sort of cultivated and, in fact, changed so they're much more efficient in what they do. What these microorganisms will do is, in fact, convert the cellulosic material directly to ethanol in a very environmentally compatible way. And by the way, the numbers that you shown for the energy efficiency is absolutely true. It applies here, too, where, in fact, we would get out much more energy than we put into the process. And the reason is when one converts cellulosic using this particular approach, what is left over is a young coal. It's the lignin. It's the purple lines. And this lignin, indeed, can be used to generate energy. It can also be used to do other things. Next slide, please. So what Moscoma is doing is comparing, let's say this is doing is the right-hand side, comparing it to traditional cellulose conversion technology, and we know there's a lot of activity in this area. Moscoma is basically simplifying the steps. So we have a simple pre-processing step followed by a fermentation using microorganisms and technology that, in fact, has already been developed at Moscoma to convert it directly to ethanol. So it's a simplification process. It uses biology and modern biotechnology. The whole idea is to have the lowest cost. Next slide, please. So as far as greenhouse gas emissions, we've seen this earlier today. The greenhouse gas emissions for cellulosic ethanol on the right are very low compared to other types of fuel sources, and this is quite attractive. Next slide, please. And that's my last slide. And so, again, all we'd want to say is cellulosic is, in fact, the next generation biofuels, and we believe Moscoma is a leader in doing this, using technology from many different companies and universities. And again, I want to thank you. I sat next to one of my heroes, so that made my entire trip worthwhile. And I also want to thank GM for making the arrangements for allowing me to come, because after all, this is my home, Hoosier, although I'm now working in the Boston area with Moscoma. So thank you very much.
Pretty interesting stuff as we're watching this technology developed to get more and more efficient in our ability to produce ethanol, and we take a look at all the various applications that there are. And here's a person who certainly knows a lot about that. So he's the General Motors Vice President of Environment and Energy. Please welcome Beth Lowry.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I thought this was kind of high, but now I know it's really high. Don't have my heels on. It's great to be here at the Speedway, and it's great to hear all of these comments. We're certainly on a mission with respect to really getting the message out on why ethanol is so important. And so when you're here at the Indy 500 and seeing how E100 is in the vehicles, it really is exciting. Chevrolet obviously has a long history in Indy, and GM's centennial year is this year. So I think it's fitting to recall Mr. Chevrolet, who raced the Indy 500 several times and then helped his brother Gaston win in 1920. So there's a long history here, and it was great to hear Emerson's stories as well. You always hear a new story when you're talking about ethanol and motorcycles and racing with Emerson. And this year, for the record 19th time, Chevrolet will lead the field to the green flag, and it's a record 10th time a Corvette has paced the field. And certainly we're thrilled that Emerson Fittipaldi is going to be at the wheel, and as we say, he's going to be in the lead all the way, because he'll be doing the pace car. The Z06 will be driving, will be the first Indy pace car powered by E85 ethanol, and it's obviously similar to the E100 that's in the actual race cars. And although it's only a concept vehicle, we think it's really important to show that performance vehicles and ethanol can go together. And so it really is important for us to continue to get the message out on how important this alternative fuel is. It's fitting that Emerson runs on E85 since it's been an ethanol refiner in its native Brazil for 30 years. Brazil is certainly a model of how ethanol helped a nation end its dependence on oil imports. And to continue to hear the great stories of Brazil, I really appreciate you coming and talking, not only here, but sharing your experience with Sweden and Saab. And obviously, we have great spokespeople for General Motors, but also for the industry. So it's really important that we get the ethanol message out there. As you know, GM is fully committed to E85. It's really the most significant near-term solution to the rising energy demand in order for us to reduce greenhouse gas emissions and offset the rising demand for oil on a global basis. And GM's focus is on next-generation ethanol and biofuels. Certainly corn, sugarcane, all that is very important. We'll continue to make sure that we get as much of that production out in the marketplace to fill the vehicles we have on the road. And we know that the ethanol can offset 35% of future vehicle energy demand by 2030. So we are certainly on this mission with all of you. And some of you are aware of our strategic alliances and investments in the last year or so. We've made two investments, one in Coscata and one in Mascoma. And taken together, these are leaders in biothermal and biochemical technologies, and they represent what we see as the best in the cellulosic ethanol future and really cover the spectrum in science and commercialization. Demonstrating the viability of sustainable waste and non-grain-based ethanol is critical to developing the infrastructure to support the flex fuel vehicle market. And the flex fuel vehicle market continues to grow. GM is the global leader in producing flex fuel vehicles. There's more than 7 million flex fuel vehicles on the road today, 3 million of those from General Motors. And along with Ford and Chrysler, we have pledged to make 50% of our production by 2012 biofuel capable. So that'll mean there'll be millions of vehicles on the road. There's no chicken and egg here. There will be vehicles that can run on flex fuel vehicles, or flex fuels. And GM will offer 15 models in 2009 that run on E85, including the Chevy HHR crossover. That's our first four-cylinder flex fuel offering. With this commitment to the vehicles, we know we have to get more stations out there in the U.S. We look to Brazil as a model, Sweden. How can we get more pumps for E85? And we've really made a significant progress there, but not enough. We just opened the 100th station recently in Fort Wayne, so that's a great accomplishment, and we'll certainly continue to make progress there. Making E85 a viable alternative fuel requires significant growth, not only in the number of stations offering the fuel, but in pricing. And so it's really important we get the economics right for the consumers, and certainly another example is Brazil. Hearing great stories of why doesn't the fuel gasoline go up in Brazil, it's because of the threat of ethanol. So we'd love to see that happen in the United States as well. So ethanol has its challenges, but we will continue to believe, as I've said, that nothing else in the near term can really make a difference for the environmental, energy security issues that we face. So we will continue to develop the flex fuel vehicles. We continue to have interaction with people around the world and how we can make more ethanol available from all sources, and that we can continue to get more stations on a global basis. So appreciate the opportunity here. Obviously, Indy 500 is a great place to come, and then to support ethanol with all of our colleagues and friends from all the various industries is really important to General Motors. So appreciate you taking the time. Thank you.
Can we have all our speakers, please, to the front? We've got at least an opportunity for a good photo op and a few questions from the crowd. We appreciate everyone's time and really attention to a very important issue. Any questions right off the bat? Looks like Don Kay has one.
Thank you.
Got a mic? It'll go on.
Hello, now it's on. For both Ms. Lowry and for Emma. Emerson, first off, do you have produced in Brazil vehicle engines that will run strictly on E85, not flex, strictly on E85? You have vehicles on the road down there that will do that?
Well, we have vehicles that are E100%.
Oh, okay.
And they are flex fuels. Anyway.
They are flex.
They are flex, yes.
All right. For Ms. Lowry, it seems to me, and I've heard, you know, there's been a lot of talk about ethanol not being an answer, that the mileage is not that good compared to gasoline, but what people don't realize is the engines that are on the road are not made for ethanol. They're made for either or, so they're primarily made for gasoline. Not once an engine is produced that will burn on ethanol, I think the mileage will jump dramatically, miles per gallon, as proved here at the, you know, the Indy cars. They run strict on it, and they went from 1.6 or 1.8 miles a gallon to 3.25. Is there any plans? Of course, there's not enough stations yet to give it, but have you got on a drawing board plans? Are you testing engines that will run strictly on ethanol?
Dead mic. That is a very good question. We had the experience of the dedicated ethanol vehicles in Brazil, and actually the customers really were more interested in making sure they had that flexibility. So you're absolutely right. If you're going to optimize a vehicle to run on E85 or E100, then you can get more improvement there. But what we've seen is, especially in the U.S. when we don't have the stations across the country, people really do like the flexibility, so there's somewhat of a trade-off. But certainly we keep working on trying to improve all of that. But I don't think you'll see dedicated vehicles. I think the history in Brazil was even people in Brazil just not having the option of having gasoline as an alternative is a concern.
Let me just compliment one point here, sorry. We have E100 cars because we are on the hot climate, so we don't need to mix gasoline here in the U.S. and in Sweden. You are using E85 and you need 15% gasoline because of the very cold climate in some parts of the country. And the question about the flex fuel cars, in Brazil, in the beginning, we adapted gasoline cars to use ethanol. But now, as ethanol is becoming more important than gasoline, some companies are studying the possibility to adapt the cars to use ethanol, more ethanol than gasoline. And because of that, we can go from 30% difference in terms of the usage of ethanol compared to gasoline to 15%. So there are many studies showing this, the possibility to have a much better performance on the ethanol side if the cars are improved to use more ethanol instead of gasoline.
Yeah, Dr. Ladish, you were talking about fractionalization. Muscoma guy. Okay. You know, you were talking about fractionalization of the, kernel. Could you just go into that a little bit more in terms of, you know, how you can multiple uses out of what to most of us appears to be one thing?
Muscoma's approach is based on biology, and what we're trying to do is take all the properties that are integrated naturally into something like sugarcane bagasse or wood or corn stover. And by breaking down the parts that give us sugar into ethanol, which is, by the way, biologically a very efficient process, we leave a lignin, a material that is left over, that is suitable not only for bioelectricity, and I really like that term. That's a very...
I learned that one today.
Yeah,
so
it's a very, very succinct way of stating it, but also being able to use these materials for making other types of fuels. The other thing the biology enables us to do is to efficiently take the sugars that are formed from the cellulosic and, in fact, direct them into different products if we wish to do so. Obviously, Muscoma's goal right now is to be the low-cost producer of ethanol, but you can imagine all the possibilities if we're successful, when we're successful, I should say.
But the idea is that you fractionalize, you know, this product.
Maybe yes.
You use one sugar for one thing, another sugar more suitable for something else, and, you know, the lignin or the outside body or the straw, you can use. So you just try to use a whole plant. Is that
yes? We use the whole plant, and we use it in a biological way without going to thermal processing. Yes.
Probably Ms. Lowry or Mr. Becker. We've had U.S. government rebates, very generous rebates for hybrid technology, gasoline, electric. When are we going to see that for flex fuel vehicles?
Well, I don't think you're going to see them anytime soon right now. We have to get through this tough period, I think, with respect to a lot of the issues that are being raised. And I think it was really important in the discussion earlier that we really have to address those issues and look at sustainable ethanol and embrace the fact that we have to really get better at communicating all the benefits and addressing some of those issues. I do think there are consumer incentives for hybrids and fuel cell vehicles and those types of vehicles. In the CAFE world, there are E85 credits for some flex fuel, but certainly we believe that as we develop the ethanol infrastructure in the United States, it would be very good public policy to get more credits for flex fuel vehicles. So we'll continue to educate people and, you know, have everybody work together on making sure that our politicians understand how important that is. But it has to come together as a system like it is in Brazil, so that you have the fuel and the vehicles and the right policy enablers. The other part is we really have to get the price of the fuel right as well. So I think it's credit for vehicles, but also the price of the fuel.
I'm a late arrival, and I don't know if on your panel there is an ethanol manufacturer, but a lot has been said lately about and blaming ethanol for the rise in food costs, which is not necessarily true. What is done now? Corn is a big product. What is done with the byproduct? It's not just thrown in the garbage. It's used and put on. So it seems to me ethanol has a problem with the public thinking, well, the raising cost of everything is blamed on ethanol because you're taking the corn. Well, you don't use sweet corn. You use field corn. But what's done with the byproduct when you're through with it?
Yeah, that's really what we do is we produce, back to the corn kernel, conventional corn, we produce about 50% of that kernel goes to cereal foods and snacks. And what we do with a lot of the byproduct first is we make ethanol out of that byproduct from the cereal process, from the snack process. So that's the first phase. And then even after that, then, you have a reduction. The way you separate the kernel, you have a reduction in fiber. So the byproduct from that fermentation process then is the distiller's grains. And in that process, we've increased the protein level. It does reduce the total distillers, but it increases the protein level and the availability to the animal. The other things that are going on, I mean, you take the fiber to gasification. Now, cellulosic opportunities are going to be developed, I believe that, and we've got some very good things in the future coming on. But now, as we speak today, we're taking our fiber off the kernel and using it in a gasifier, which is a nice way of saying you environmentally extract energy off that fiber and create steam, and that steam then converts the starch over to ethanol, helps in that process. So there are technologies that are coming online that will continue to improve this food and fuel opportunity. And additionally, as I say, I mean, you mentioned corn stover and the cellulosic conversion. We can have our cornbread and eat it too, if you will. I mean, we can do things whereby we've got the grain and we also have the stover, the cellulosic material. And we're on the very front end of these technologies, and that's why I believe, the subsidies of the industry are being questioned at times. Think of the technology that this economic opportunity has driven and where we're at today and where we will be. It won't be long, and we'll have tremendous opportunities for all of these processes. Not any single one of them will probably be the sole answer. We're going to need all of them to happen. You're still going to need food products that corn can produce, and the stover then can contribute to cellulosic, the sugar canes, and all the other products. On wasteland or poor quality soils, we'll produce things like switchgrass. But those technologies are all very, very close. In the case of corn separation, it's here. We're doing it today. The ethanol these guys are burning today was made from the lower quality portions of the kernel off of the product that could not be used for food.
I do think it's important that people collectively get the word out, because obviously there is a concern about food prices, but it's not because of biofuels. It's because of the price of oil. It's because of the drought conditions in Australia. It's because of people in developing countries requiring more food at a different level of food. So there are a whole host of reasons besides biofuels. It just has been convenient to just point the finger at biofuels here in the U.S. Well, actually, globally, too.
And the USDA is saying we're going to have about a 1.4 billion bushel carryout of the corn crop this year. So, I mean, there's not a shortage in the U.S. of corn.
All the way at the back.
Hi. This message is for, or a question for Beth. You mentioned E85 several times in your remarks. Can you tell me what GM's position is on the movement towards higher blends, such as E20 and E30?
Sure. Right now, our vehicles are certified for E10, and our flex fuel vehicles are certified for E85. And so what we've said with respect to whether you can go to an E10 or E12, or E15, E20, we have to do the necessary testing to make sure the vehicles can accommodate those blends. Obviously, our flex fuel vehicles can accommodate any blend of ethanol. So we'll continue to work with the Department of Energy, EPA, and others to get the right data out there. We certainly want to make sure the ethanol producers have lots of places for ethanol. We certainly believe E85 is the best way to do that. We're not going to hit the blend wall if we had stations around the country that were handling E85. But we also know that if we have to go to some other blends, we just need to know what it does to our vehicles. And it probably will be fine, but what we need to do is also focus on the small engine manufacturers and, you know, snow blowers and weed whackers. They're concerned, and we don't want ethanol to have any concerns with respect to people using those types of motors. As we've said, if you have a problem with ethanol with your snowblower or your weed whacker, you're going to look at your car that's a, you know, your second investment versus your house, and you might have a concern. So we don't want to have a growing concern with respect to the quality and reliability of vehicles related to ethanol.
Sure, that makes good sense. Just one follow-up then. In your promotion, though, of flex fuel vehicles, you would support a flex fuel vehicle using a higher blend of ethanol. You're not going to just focus on E85. If you buy a flex fuel vehicle in the sales process and promotion process, you wouldn't have a problem with saying, hey, you know, a higher blend level is fine.
Actually, the EPIC folks and everybody else knows we've been working on this to figure out how to get the message out there. What we were trying to do is make sure we didn't confuse people because we have been on the E10, E85, and with all the controversy right now. So, you know, obviously our flex fuel vehicles can use any blend of ethanol. So we also were trying to promote getting more E85 stations out there. So it's an important balance.
Okay, thank you.
Right up front.
My name is Håkan Mattsson from Sweden. I have a question to the whole panel. I would like you to estimate how much money the anti-ethanol lobby is putting in and where the money come from. Maybe we can start from right to left.
The anti-ethanol lobbies. I think they are stronger in Europe compared to U.S. today. Because the U.S. approved the renewable fuels standard last year. This year there's a discussion about food versus fuel, but I agree with you. It's really a question of the very high oil price. It's incredible how people do not talk about oil price at $130 a barrel. They talk about the 1% that biofuels represent in the fossil fuel world. They don't talk about the other 99% and the costs of having diesel, very expensive diesel, in all countries. And it affects, of course, agricultural prices. But in my opinion, the big problem is that Europe has many different positions. So it's a very heterogeneous situation. In Sweden, for example, we have a very positive example of a country that has been importing ethanol, competitive ethanol, investing in Africa today. They have one-third of the gas stations are E85. They have a stronger fleet. Very important fleet of flex fuel cars now running with ethanol, with E85. And then you have other countries like Germany, for example, that has been very negative. In my opinion, the problem is that in Germany there's a combination of resistance from the oil industry, the car industry, because in some ways the car industry in Europe has been working very hard to have good diesel cars. Light cars moved on diesel, and then ethanol could be a problem for them. And then NGOs and environmental groups together. It's not organized, but it's becoming very hard in terms of public opinion, especially in Germany. There is also some resistance now in UK and in the Netherlands. There's where I see most problematic, especially because the EU will be approving the new directive to use 10% biofuels in the next 15 years.
Well, you know, on my side, I've been doing presentation because I'm a big investor on the ethanol unit. I'm building a refinery of 4 million tons crushing capacity on the center state of Brazil that's called Mato Grosso do Sul. It's a new area for develop for ethanol industry in Brazil. And you know, I'm very happy to say that we're going to generate around 5,000 jobs around our refinery. And the perception, like Marco said, in Europe, I've been doing presentations in London, in China, in New York, and most of the European, they come to us and say, well, there is slavery, there's miners working, no social benefits, no social security, and you guys invading Amazons. I mean, like Marx explained, we're only using 1% of the agriculture area of Brazil. All the new refineries in Brazil are very much into the social benefit for the employees. They have a very... The Brazilian government is completely structured and watching the way that each new unit is being built and the benefits for the employees. And we don't use slavery, don't use miners. I mean, it's a great industry, it's growing, and that's the lobby we have against us. You know, this perception, most in Europe countries, that we are, you know, invading forests, we are reducing the forests in Brazil, and that's not true. We have a lot of cattle fields available to us to plant sugar cane in Brazil. Cattle field has been, you know, the new cattle industry in Brazil is going to confinement. And when you go to confinement, you don't need the big areas. And all these open fields are there, available for us. We're not competing, like Marco said, against the food chain in Brazil, not at all. And it's very disappointing when you arrive in a presentation in Europe and people start saying, you know, how about the children, how about the forest, and that's it's not happen. I started 3 years ago the project. I've been on the agriculture field in Brazil on the orange plantation for 35 years in Brazil. I have a very efficient orange farm in Brazil, fully irrigated on the central of the citrus area of Brazil. And we live with sugar cane around us because we're orange citrus area, you have sugar cane. And that means all these lobbyists against us is not correct in Brazil. I mean, I don't know how much money they're investing against us, but the perception is wrong. I mean, we have a very clean social benefit to the employees, new jobs, a new future for these people. It means I'm very proud to say that we are offering a new life on places that people was completely poverty type of life, and they are going to have income, social, medical insurance, etc., etc. I'm very happy to help to get new jobs in Brazil on my investment.
Folks, we're a little pressed for time, so what I would like to do, some of these folks will be available for that question. I've got one additional question back here, and that will be the final one because we're running into a little time crunch. So, sir, at the back.
This question is for Emerson. First off, it's a pleasure to have you here. You spoke earlier about Brazil and using ethanol quite a while back on your motorcycle and some of the other things. now we have a green racing movement, if you will, and the IndyCar series has certainly started that by switching to 100% fuel-grade ethanol. You have the Corvette race team running on E85 and a lot of grassroots racers interested in running renewable fuels. I just was wondering if you could comment on where this green racing movement is going and what it has done for racing.
Well, you know, I think, you know, starting Indianapolis is a great move. I think showing the world, you know, the efficiency of the ethanol is showing the world that as alternative fuel, it works really well on racing engines. As we know, any racing engines always work in the limit. You know, I'm very proud of the Corvette program, the E85, to show the world. I mean, it will be the first time ever that the pace car will be run by E85, by ethanol. I'm sure that, you know, the Indy 500 will be televised globally. It's one of the biggest sports events in the world. And I know, you know, that even Marcus told me that Bernie Ecclestone from Formula One has been contacting him like a year ago, just before the Brazilian Grand Prix, to follow up our steps here. You know, Formula One is thinking to go green on the near future, at least to have a part of ethanol. I mean, I don't know if I was supposed to say this, but but he contacted, Bernie contacted. This was after Indianapolis. You know, Indianapolis Motor Speedway established the 100% ethanol on the IRL, and I think that's a great move. And a lot of different categories in the world. I'm involved with A1 GP. I have the Brazilian team, and we are talking. I had meetings with Unica that the new category should go full ethanol in the near future. We are following Indianapolis. I mean, Indianapolis was the leader, and that's. I'm very happy to be here with the Speedway, with Chevrolet, with GM, to be the leading example for race in the world.
Very good, and hopefully if you have some additional questions for some of these individuals, they'll be available to you. We appreciate you very much coming to the Ethanol Summit. Thank you, all of you, for your time and energy here. We appreciate you very much coming by.